There were quite a few serendipitous moments in my life as a music collector. One of the best happened when, as a junior in high school, I was taking a shortcut through the girls' dorm, and an acquaintance from the dance department, we were friendly but not really friends, suddenly thrust 3 records in my hand and told me to go listen to them. I have no idea why she did it. We'd never talked about music at all, and never really spent any time together, but there she was, handing over the small stack of vinyl that would forever alter my life. I'm embarrassed to admit that I don't even remember her name. Hillary, maybe. All the records she gave me were top-notch. One of the singles was by a band called The Teardrop Explodes and was called When I Dream. I've been thinking about you, I hope that you've been thinking about me. I've been talking about you, I've been talking about you in my sleep. There was a long history of stupid names in popular music, but it seemed like British bands in the 80s were really trying to outdo each other with absurdity. The Teardrop Explodes, Haircut 100, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. What was in the water over there? At any rate, When I Dream is a great song, far and away the best thing they ever did as a group. It is impossibly buoyant and happy while still being coolly detached, and I have yet to play it for anybody that doesn't immediately respond to it. The singles I listened to that day were great examples of an early new wave. They used the traditional instrumentation of a rock band, but the melodies were all angular and alienating, and the arrangements were unusual and creative and unlike anything you could hear on the radio, especially in northern Michigan. But it was the final single that was an absolute revelation. It was by some group called Visage, reasonable enough name, and the song was called Fade to Grey. Visage was not a band, at least not in the traditional sense, because they used primarily synthesizers over an artificial four-on-the-floor dance beat. This was shortly after my breakthrough discovery of Ultravox's Vienna album that finally entwined the thrill of the beat with the excitement of synthetic sound. and the Visage single seemed cut from the same cloth. And no wonder. As it turned out, half the members of Visage came from Ultravox. The song starts with lightly played shifting chords before giving way to the sequenced pulse that runs throughout the piece. A couple of measures to set the tempo, and then there's a spine-chilling electronic glissando, heavy on the echo, that arcs up to heaven as the beat kicks in. A warbly synthetic string section fills the sound out, and a lushly layered, wordless vocal mimics that call to the sky, and the song is off and running. The whole sound is so elegant and lush, while still being oddly cold, that it just pulled me in immediately. The lyrics are typically disjointed new wavy lyrics that don't really mean anything but are heavy on atmosphere. An essential French female voice beckons, Sefanir Angri. I was entranced. Visage, as it turned out, was created at a dance club, Billy's, in London. While the social and political climate was brutal and bleak, and the righteous anger of the punks ruled the streets outside, Billy's offered a haven from the ugliness. Playing mostly Kraftwerk and David Bowie and Roxy music, Billy's was an elegant and sophisticated, or pretentious and fey, depending on your perspective, oasis, where ultra-chic Europeans in their finest threads came to see and be seen and forget the troubles of the world in their glamorous cocoon. Billy's is where the New Romantic movement started, and it was exactly as the name implied, a willful ignorance of the brutal realities of urban life by putting on deeply tinted rose-colored glasses and fancy suits and drinking and dancing and mingling in that peculiarly European combination of elegance and decay, which I guess might as well be the etymological source of the word decadence. The center and symbol of this luxuriously decadent club was Steve Strange, an ex-punk who had reinvented himself using the most outrageous clothes and makeup imaginable. This is where New Wave got a lot of its look, and Strange used to play dress-up in elegant suits or romantic pirate garb with breathtakingly surreal makeup, sometimes more like landscapes painted on his face than anything anybody used to highlight their lips or eyes. Leading them on. It was in stark contrast to the embrace of ugliness that punks symbolized, but it would turn out to have just as much, if not more, influence on the look and sound of the 1980s. Steve Strange and his mate, Rusty Egan, a DJ and former band member as well, wanted to record some new music to fit into the club's playlist. Rusty's former bandmate from the Rich Kids, Midge Ure, offered them some studio time and helped them record their first song, a tarted up cover of Zagar and Evans in the year 2525. The song was a big success at the club, and Ure stayed on to work on some more music with them. Ultravox's Billy Curie joined them. Midge Ure, if you've been paying attention, was in the process of taking over singing and songwriting duties for Ultravox from John Fox, along with three members of the band Magazine, including bassist Barry Adamson, who would later go on to a remarkable solo career writing imaginary film noir soundtracks, and Visage was officially born. They released another single, the strange anti-smoking Tar, which was also well received in the club, and then sat down to record an entire album. Released in 1980, the same year as Ultravox's Vienna, that eponymous album contained Fade to Grey, which burst out of Billy's and washed over the world, heralding the coming of synthpop. But, being stuck in Michigan, I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know there was an album's worth of material. I didn't know who was in the band or what their affiliation with my beloved Ultravox was. For such a big music fan, I have a curious aversion to reading any music magazines. All I knew was Fade to Grey, and I held it close to my heart. That was in the spring of 1981, well after the album had been released. It was one of the most fruitful times of my early music collecting, where I really came into my own and started discovering lots of music that really spoke to me. Kraftwerk, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Talking Heads, Byrne and Eno's remarkable My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, Lena Lovitch, David Bowie, Visage, Japan. Every time I turned around, I stumbled across another phenomenal vein of sonic gold. It was also the first year I lived away from home, although it was a 5-minute walk away, and the year I met Eric and became his roommate. It was probably the most condensely packed time of growth in my life, and it set me well on my way to becoming who I am today. Coming back to school the next year, my senior year, and a rare fourth year at Interlaken, most people come for the junior and senior years only, I was large and in charge. I knew what I liked, I knew who I was, I knew my friends and they knew me. I was on top of my game and on top of my life in a way that I had never been before. Or since, with the possible exception of my last year at Hampshire College. All I needed was a girlfriend, a physical girlfriend. I had lots of intimate relationships with girls and boys, but none of them were physical. Like anybody else, I wanted to be loved completely for who I was, physically as well as mentally, emotionally, and psychologically. Will you love me tomorrow? Shy beyond reason or words because of past experiences, I was at a severe disadvantage. Terrified of ruining a friendship with inappropriate physical desire, I crammed that desire in a dark corner and tried to lock it away for good, while simultaneously longing for someone to come along with a golden key that would set it and me free. The woman that did that would have to be strong and persistent and make the first move and be infinitely patient with me in my extremely fragile sexuality. Will you still love me tomorrow? Tonight with words unspoken, you said that I'm the only one. This is another way in which I had a stereotypically feminine sexuality. Although the rules were changing, the social convention was largely that the guy was the aggressor, initiating contact, and the girl waited patiently for her phone to ring. But there I was, shot down after my first few fumbling attempts, sitting by the silent phone, waiting for it to ring. And then Tina called. Although not a particularly aggressive woman, she liked me enough to hang in there and was persistent enough not to take my shyness as rejection. Our courtship has been covered elsewhere, but it came to a head right before Christmas break. We had been set up at a party the night before the three-week break started and left alone and drunk by our impatient friends, who just wanted us to hurry up and read the writing that was scrawled in gigantic letters across the wall. "You like each other, stupids," it said, but we were too frightened to read it. The rum helped us make out the letters, and we ended up dancing a private pas de deux in a dark studio of the dance building. Will you still love me tomorrow? Being the last night of school before break, the staff of the dorms relaxed their grip a bit. We were supposed to be sealed in our respective dorms, all present and accounted for, by 10 p.m., but as people had already started leaving and buses were already shuttling people to the airport for late night or early morning flights home, they left the doors unlocked and turned a blind eye to the comings and goings of their charges. Not smart, perhaps, or even legal, but it was greatly appreciated. It was a tradition to stay up all night the night before break, and I was only too eager to follow tradition. Tina had a very early shuttle to catch, so I walked her back to her dorm after our duet, held her hand, my heart practically flew like a hummingbird out of the cage of my ribs, and wished her Merry Christmas. I'd like to know that your love is love I can be sure of. So tell me now, and I won't ask again. Will you still love me tomorrow? Dawn spread slowly across the morning sky. A bottle of crimson syrup knocked over on a black table, and the day began. Bleary and tired, I wished my friends well on their vacations, saw them off, and walked across the highway with a bag of dirty clothes to my house. My trip home was easily the shortest of all my friends, but as it turned out, we weren't going to be spending Christmas at home, We were going down to Florida to visit my soon-to-be stepfather's parents, and the plane left that afternoon. No time for a nap, and in my supercharged adolescent state, no need for one, I did laundry, repacked my bags, and the three of us, me, my mom, and Frank, got in the car and drove to the airport. The migration south was long and uneventful. I spent most of it watching the snow disappear from the ground 30,000 feet below us and swimming in the delicious memories of Eric and Eva and Bob and Dave and, most especially of all, of Tina. It was a remarkable semester, and I had much to think about, and much more to look forward to. We got to Florida around midnight, and were met at the airport by Frank's parents. By now, I had been up for a little over 40 hours, and it was starting to show. We drove for an hour to get to their house, and I was so tired that I started to hallucinate in the back seat of the car, slipping suddenly into the dream state while I was still awake. We pulled up to the house, and I dragged myself and my bag out of the car and into the kitchen. Frank's parents offered me some fresh orange juice, squeezed from the fruit of their own tree growing in the backyard. I had never been to Florida, and the balmy breezes in the middle of December and fresh oranges growing right outside the window seemed impossibly exotic. So, almost too tired to stand anymore, I said, "Sure, that would be nice." Frank's dad took a bottle out of the refrigerator and wrestled with the cap, which was pretty badly stuck. What we didn't know was that the orange juice had fermented, and when he finally did pop the top off, the entire bottle exploded all over me. Too tired to laugh, although I was the only one there that didn't find extreme humor in the situation, I refused the offer of something else, begged to be shown where I would be sleeping, and crawled into a sleeping bag set on couch cushions in the office, sticky and smelling of rotten fruit.
A red rose for the dead poses rise like a daffodil's heartbeat. Multicolored pill landing in the classroom of assorted young stars. Shooting dead lightning. Purple raindrops earth a simulator. Stop the trickle of a Navajo mission on a golden plane. WD-40 cleans the rust off Beelzebub's top lip. And the shimmer of the new age. Fat chain maintains a yin and yang finger.
Our time in Florida was pretty good. Split about evenly between things that were genuinely fun, Disney World, and my discovery of how to surreptitiously jam the escalators while just standing on them in a particular way, and things that were only fun with distance and hindsight. The bizarre food Frank's parents insisted on feeding us, fishneck soup, oatmeal that had been left to cool in the bowl overnight, intentionally, and our big dinner out at their favorite family-style cafeteria. All you can stomach. It was probably a stressful trip for my mom, who was, after all, the other woman and homewrecker, but I was pretty oblivious to all that, lost in my reveries of young love.
They say for every boy and girl there's just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine. The heavenly touch of your embrace tells me no one could take your place ever in my heart. Young love.
Statistically, the worst place to find cool music is at a record store in a mall, as I discovered from my disastrous attempt to order Synergy's Sequencer album from Camelot Music at the Cherryland Mall in Traverse City. Catering only to what I call the yellow line, or the middle of the middle of the road, mall stores are almost entirely free of anything edgy or cool. But every once in a great while, somebody will order something by mistake, and it'll make its way almost immediately to a cutout bin, so it's worth checking out every now and then, especially if you have no other options. I picked up Ministry's Twitch for $2 at a mall in Massachusetts, and I found a couple of cutout Nectar records in a bin of things that were about to be thrown out at the aforementioned Camelot Music. And wandering through a mall in Florida on that trip, I accidentally stumbled across the full Visage album. Stunned, I immediately snapped it up. We got back to Frank's folks' house, and I was dying to listen to it, but my mom and Frank were both extremely hesitant to let me play it, not wanting to disturb or alienate his parents with my crazy teenage music. Frank's father noticed me studying the album cover and asked about it. I proudly told him a little about the New Romantics that I felt such kinship with, and he ridiculed me for it.
New styles, new shapes, new molds, that's a role my passion takes.
At his age, having survived dozens of fads and cultural upheavals, from flappers to hippies, he must have felt that my devotion to this tiny little self-consciously arty movement was foolish and trivial. I'm sure he didn't mean to hurt my feelings, but his comments stung, and I withdrew from the conversation, saying I hadn't quite caught up on my sleep and would like to take a nap in the office before dinner. Wish granted, I closed the door and quietly pulled the speakers into the middle of the room, placed them about a foot apart from each other, turned the stereo onto its quietest setting, inaudible even across the same room, and lay down with my head between the speakers to hear the faint, tinny sounds of Visage. Although it would be a week before I got to hear it properly, I could tell it was an exceptional album, and I was thrilled beyond words to have finally procured it, however unlikely the circumstances were. We'll be right back. Having been born in a club, it's no surprise to find that the album's focus is the dance floor, with the first three tracks blending seamlessly into each other to create a non-stop 12-minute disco mix. One criticism of New Romantics was their pretentious seriousness about the scene, but Visage also showed a refreshing sense of humor on the track Mal Paso Man, a song about, unlikely enough, Clint Eastwood that faintly echoed Ennio Morricone's iconic theme for the good, the bad, and the ugly. After Christmas break, Tina and I hesitantly picked up where we left off, and at her instigation, of course, officially became boyfriend and girlfriend. She immediately embraced Fade to Grey, and we proudly wore the New Romantic label. We couldn't afford the clothes or the makeup for it, but we internalized its ideals. We were both romantics anyway, and into the hearts and flowers aspects of love. I have a box of love letters from her that, 20 years later, still smells faintly of opium, her preferred perfume, and, not surprisingly, one of my all-time favorite smells. Those were heady days with Tina, the two of us enveloped in a cocoon of young love. On dance tour, we sat together on the bus, holding hands, both plugged into the same Walkman, listening to Visage and Ultravox and Lena Lovitch. She was deeply cynical and guarded around almost everybody but me, and I was just starting to develop the bitterness that would grow into a poisonous, choking vine in Chicago the following year. For me, she opened like a flower, and I drank deep of her nectar, profoundly grateful to have found somebody who loved me completely, emotionally and psychologically, but most important of all for me at the time, physically as well. We were New Romantics in many ways, musically, sure, but our love allowed us to express our dormant romanticism and optimism with each other in a way we couldn't with others. In an ugly and scary world, perpetually on the brink of complete annihilation, surrounded by the selfishness of the looking out for number one attitudes that were burning through the American society of the 1980s, Tina and I took refuge in each other. Sitting on the bus, sharing a secret, we held each other close and let the ugliness of the outside world se finir en gris.
Sans la pluie comme un été anglais, entend les notes d'une chanson lointaine, sortant de derrière